Welcome to the Making Sense Podcast. This is Sam Harris. Today I'm speaking with Rabbi David Wolpe. David is a visiting scholar at Harvard Divinity School. He is a rabbinic fellow at the Anti-Defamation League, a senior advisor to the Maimonides Fund, and the emeritus rabbi at Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. And because he's at Harvard, he's had a front seat view of the recent controversy around anti-Semitism and free speech. I spoke to him before the president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, resigned in the aftermath of that terrible testimony before Congress. Elizabeth McGill, the president of Penn, resigned first, and Claudine Gay resigned last week, though she's still a professor at Harvard. She resigned for reasons that were unrelated to her testimony, however. It seemed that she had an impressive pattern of academic misconduct, namely plagiarism. Many people on the left are alleging that racism is the reason she was forced out. That is clearly not the case. I'm sure she was personally subjected to a lot of racist abuse in the aftermath of her testimony before Congress. I don't doubt that, and I'm sure that was awful. But as for her being forced to resign from the presidency of Harvard, that was not a racist mobbing of her. And the painful irony is that it was concern about racism and sexism, perhaps, that explains why she occupied the position of the presidency of Harvard in the first place. As many people have pointed out, it is very difficult to imagine a white man with her academic record getting anywhere near the presidency of Harvard. Nor would a white man, having been found out for academic misconduct, have been defended so fulsomely by the institution, even in the wake of resigning. Honestly, the whole episode, the more you look at it, is diagnostic for what is wrong with the current DEI regime in our institutions. And of course, DEI was largely responsible for the explosion of anti-Semitism we saw on our college campuses, including Harvard, where over 30 student organizations on October 8th, before Israel had dropped a single bomb in Gaza, came out in support of Hamas, claiming that Israel was, quote, solely responsible for the atrocities of October 7th. This derangement of ethical and political thinking was the result of the DEI ideology, this oppressor and oppressed narrative that has captured everything on the left. Anyway, Rabbi Wolpe and I get into that. We talk about the global response to the atrocities of October 7th. We discuss the difference between Israeli and diaspora Jews, the history and logic of anti-Semitism, the role of conspiracy theories, so-called great replacement theory, reasons for Jewish success, right-wing anti-Semitism, left-wing anti-Semitism, the response of Harvard University to October 7th, the college president's testimony before Congress, the future of DEI and civil discourse, the BDS movement, anti-Semitism versus anti-Zionism, declining Jewish attendance at Ivy League universities, the anti-Semitism that is endemic to Islam, foreign funding of U.S. universities, and other topics. And now I bring you Rabbi David Wolpe. I am here with Rabbi David Wolpe. David, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
So you were once named the most influential rabbi in America by Newsweek, and I noticed that this happened after we had our public debate, so apparently none of my atheist rhetorical skills were able to diminish your stature. You only rose in stature after I put into challenge your entire worldview, so much for that.
I used to say, you know, for about 6 years in the history of the Jewish people, there was a Most Influential Rabbi Award. And it happened to be when I was like, while I was doing all these debates, had it been any other time in Jewish history, I never would have been able to put that on my resume. But for that brief time, there were a couple of people who got together and decided to give this award. Yeah. So yeah. I was very lucky, but actually, people still say to me, you know, I saw your debate with Sam Harris. Nobody says to me, and you won, so.
Well, for at least one of them, I had Hitch on my team, too, which was also an advantage.
Yes.
And that was fun. Those were fun debates. I've had many encounters that are not fun, and it's not fun on stage, and it's not fun in the green room, but it's always been fun hanging with you.
Thank you. I feel the same.
But we've got other topics to touch here, and I don't, maybe we'll find something to disagree about, but I don't think there'll be much. You've since been teaching at Harvard, and how's that going? It's uneventful?
So, yeah, right. I remember I saw you actually before I went, and I told you that I was going, and my aim was to do research and to write and to teach this coming semester. But then October 7th hit and everything changed. I mean, for the world, for Israel, certainly for Harvard, and completely for me.
Yes, that's obviously what I want to get into. So for me, as someone who has considered himself a somewhat distant student of Jewish history and anti-Semitism, I confess that I always viewed the problem of anti-Semitism more or less in the rearview mirror. I mean, I viewed it as a problem of history rather than a present concern. I mean, I knew that it still existed, and it's existed in various contexts that we'll talk about. But, you know, I felt fairly blindsided by not October 7th itself, but the response to it that we saw most gallingly in our nation's finest educational institutions, or what purport to be. What changed for you after October 7th? I mean, did you, I think you're probably a much closer, or have been a much closer observer of anti-Semitism than I've been, being a rabbi. How surprised were you in the aftermath of October 7th?
I think that you and I grew up actually in a strange interregnum in anti-Semitism, because post the Holocaust, I mean, my father, who was a conservative rabbi most of his life in Philadelphia, for him, anti-Semitism was real and a going concern. And I remember when I was ordained and afterwards, I thought, okay, anti-Semitism was the concern then, but now not so much. And the truth is, for the last, I don't know, I would say starting maybe 20 years ago and back to, I don't know, the 60s or the 70s, it was really a minimal concern compared to the way that Jews had been obsessed and preoccupied with it for all of Jewish history. So I, like you, was, I had certainly more experience with it day to day. A large part of my congregation in Los Angeles was from Iran, and they had obviously fled anti-Semitism. Mm. But I was surprised at the explosive nature of anti-Semitism all over America and the world, certainly on college campuses, but not only on college campuses. Yeah, it a little bit shocked me and dispirited me, because as we can talk about, you know, it's not only coming from one political direction, even though on campus, it's almost entirely from one direction.
Yeah, well, so we'll focus on the various institutions in a minute. I definitely want to talk about the college campus problem in particular. Mm-hmm. But I just want to get some more of your experience here over the years. I mean, how much time have you spent in Israel? How close is your connection there?
I've spent a lot of time in Israel. I'm usually there at least a couple times a year, and I lived there as a student, and I have constant touch with friends and colleagues in Israel.
Mm. And how do you view the relationship between Israeli Jews and diaspora Jews, I mean, Jews elsewhere in the world, in particular in America? I mean, I can imagine that, you know, post October 7th, the experience for American Jews and really, you know, all Jews outside of Israel is one of a sudden sense of implication in what's happening there that has never, I mean, it's always been, it's possible to have felt that long before this moment, but this really was a September 11th moment for all the world's Jews in a way. And again, it was not, you know, the atrocities aside, it really was in how they were responded to that suddenly everything seemed upside down and in need of a hard reset. So how do you think about the relationship between Jews inside of Israel and everywhere else.
One of the interesting things that happened as a result of October 7th is it resolved a long, in some ways, a long debate in Jewish, you know, inner circles, which is Israeli Jews, for understandable reasons, sort of felt disconnected from the diaspora. They felt as though, look, we live in Israel. We're the ones who are living on the front lines of Jewish history. We're the ones who are busy building a state. And you guys in Los Angeles or in Wichita or Miami or Chicago or Paris or London, you're living nice lives and you're Jewish and maybe every now and then you face something. But the truth is you're not in this boat together the way we are. And October 7th changed that. And it changed it for both directions. That is, as you said, diaspora Jews finally said, oh my God, all of us have to take a position on this. We're all part of this. We're all in this circle, whether we want to be or not. And Jews in Israel all of a sudden realized, actually, the Jews of the diaspora are part of our enterprise, even though we don't normally think of them that way. And it really matters what they say. And look what's happening on campuses because they're Jews and they're supporting us or speaking about us. So in a strange way, Abba Eban once said, Jews like their clouds without silver linings. But there are sometimes some silver linings here. And one of them is that I think it created a certain solidarity of Jews around the world because nobody could be indifferent, or almost no one could be indifferent to this, you know, dilemma.
And how do you think about anti-Semitism historically? I mean, it's just this ever protean and perfectly durable hatred. It's been interesting to watch, again, in the aftermath of October 7th, people grapple with the concept and try to understand it. I mean, it's just, yes. It's, you know, the history, I think we can trace the history, you know, loosely, you know, from Christian theology 2,000 years ago. And I mean, there are a few salient landmarks in the last two millennia. I mean, one in particular is the racialized form it took in the 19th century. I think the term anti-Semitic first appears in the 1850s.
Yep.
And then we have the contributions of Russia with the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, forgery, and in America we have Henry Ford, and the synergy between his mania and the Third Reich. And obviously, all of this takes the most painful and consequential form in with the Nazis and the Holocaust. But in the aftermath of that, we have, at least to my eye, three strands of anti-Semitism that we almost have to talk about separately. One is the great reservoir of Muslim anti-Semitism, which was given, it has its theological roots, obviously, but it was given a fair amount of topspin and inspiration from the Nazis. And then we have, especially, you know, in an American context especially, but it's, you know, I guess it's true throughout the West at the moment, we have on, you know, both anti-Semitism on the far left and on the far right, and they're different. It's a deeply inconvenient fact for Jews that if you go far enough in either direction on the political landscape, you meet stark anti-Semitism. And for opposite reasons. So there really is no winning. I mean, to speak about it loosely, you know, on the far left, Jews are considered to have an extra helping of white privilege.
Yes.
And on the far right, Jews are considered not to be white and therefore are condemned and hated as non-white, you know, interlopers in the otherwise pure society. I mean, that's a very quick gloss of how I've been seeing things, but give me your picture of anti-Semitism.
I will end up in the same place, although I'll take a couple different stops in the destination to get there. First of all, I think it's important to remember that one driver of anti-Semitism, and as you said, it is a protean hatred. I mean, people hate Jews for being capitalists, for being communists, for being stateless, for being in a state, for wandering, for being in a place, for being powerless, for being powerful. There's nothing for which you cannot hate Jews on the left, on the right, as you said. But as you said, first of all, the fact that Jews were other was really significant all through history because they were the minority in other people's lands ever since they were kicked out of their own. And, you know, as I said once or twice in debates, actually, you know, if you think that human beings are basically good, you should visit a playground. And when you go to a playground, a new kid comes on the playground, they don't say, oh, look, a new child, you know, let us share our toys. No, there's something about otherness that makes us uncomfortable. That was then given really, as you said, theologic rocket fuel because of Jews and Jesus. Because Jesus was Jewish, the Jews did not accept him as the Messiah. And now just think about this psychologically. If God walks on earth and you don't, and he's standing right next to you, and after all, he's part of the Jewish community, and you don't see him as God, you're either foolish or wicked. There are no other choices. Because it can't be that God's not impressive or that God's not God. And so what is really a family quarrel, which is what it was with Jesus, because everybody was Jewish, a family quarrel, which are sometimes the most toxic, got enshrined in sacred books. And that, here I will make a concession to your side of the debate, that's not a good thing because that doesn't change. And so Christian, the roots of Christian anti-Semitism, Hyman Maccabee, the English scholar, had a theory about this that's very interesting. He said, Judaism is one of the few hatreds where you're both subhuman and superhuman, because to kill a god, you have to be a devil. You can't just be a bad person. And so from the beginning, hatred of Jews was supercharged. And then, by the way, many people are not aware of this, Muhammad made the same assumption that early Christianity did, which was Jews would convert to Islam. And when they refused to convert, you get in the Quran as well, not with the same degree of toxicity as the New Testament, but it's still, there are some pretty awful verses in the Quran about Jews. And I just want to say, before we get too complacent, that Jews are probably lucky that no Canaanites are still around, because, you know, the Bible has its moments too. But Jews are still around.
Amalekites.
And the Amalekites especially, if you want to go to the to the darkest. But Jews are still around. And so in land after land after land, they were a minority with the Christians, a minority with the Muslims, and the other. And the reason that America has always been different, I think, is that there were Frenchmen and Jews, there were Germans and Jews, there were Russians and Jews, but there aren't Americans and Jews. There are so many different groups that Jews were not the identified other. But on the fringes, they're still seen for different reasons as the other. And as you said, today we get those three strands. You get the far right, you get the far left, and the Islamists. And all three have different reasons, but form weird alliances in their hostility, which is to end up in a place that you did not end up in, which is where you get those strange signs like Queers for Hamas, which is totally inexplicable unless you understand that they're united by antipathy.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it all becomes an SNL sketch,
right?
Which is
exactly
probably written by a disproportionate number of Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Let's start with the far right component of this, because I think the far left component will take us to college campuses where we should focus. But how do you understand the anti-Semitism of the right? And I guess the American context is the right one to think about. I mean, and some of this has been in the news in pieces of late, really having nothing to do with October 7th. So you have people like Tucker Carlson and, you know, Vivek Ramaswamy, you know, flirting with, not beyond flirting, actually just fully endorsing so-called great replacement theory. You know, many people were bewildered to hear those good Americans in Charlottesville with their tiki torches chanting, Jews will not replace us, and didn't know what that was about. But there's this idea that Democrats in general, leftists in general, but really Jews in this insidious backroom way are consciously trying to engineer future electoral victories by just letting the dispossessed people of the world flood the country through open borders, as though that were a reliable way of producing, you know, democratic victories in elections. We're noticing now that this is, you know, there's a
even that
certainly
doesn't
a fair
work.
Number of Arabs, yeah, a fair number of Arabs now who are not inclined to vote Democratic in the aftermath of October 7th. How do you think about the far right problem?
So, for one of the, I almost want to say interesting, if it weren't so tragic, it would be interesting, things about anti-Semitism, unlike other hatreds again, is it's almost always a conspiracy theory, which is a feature. I mean, look, you and Michael Shermer and others have explored the conspiratorial mind. All I can say about it is, for whatever reason, almost always you will find among anti-Semites that Jews are somehow conspiring to do something terrible in the world. And whatever it is they fear, it is the Jew that has created that which they fear. And so if you're right-wing white American who fears being replaced by minorities, obviously it's engineered by the Jews because things can't happen without an explanation. And there's always the Jewish possibility, and Jews being such a small population. I mean, 2% of America, like 0.02% of the world, their prominence allows conspiracy theories to have, you know, life on social media and in people's minds, because as an example, like they would point to Paul Wolfowitz and say, ah, you see, you know, the war in Iraq is a Jewish conspiracy, regardless of the fact that the president and the vice president and the secretary of state and so on, none of them were Jewish. But that's right. Irrelevant, because it's always got to be the person who is tied to this international conspiracy. And that's what's happening right now with the quote unquote great replacement theory. It's engineered by the Jews, which is a bizarre but very persistent feature of anti-Semitism. You mentioned the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. That was a Russian forgery about Jewish bankers who control the world. And weirdly, I am told, I don't know this firsthand, you can find that book in hotel rooms in Jordan, like, you know, the way Gideon Bible was given in. And so there is this, it links all people who want to believe that everything bad in their life is due to someone else planning it, that it would be bad. And it's almost always the Jew. I mean, just think of the caricatures of the Jew, like as a predator holding the globe and spinning it, you know, to their will.
Yeah, I remember, this is now jumping to the Muslim context for a minute, but I remember our friend Ayan Hirsi Ali telling me that when she was in Somalia and, by her account, had never met a person who had ever met a person who had met a Jew, still they knew they hated the Jews because of all their evil work in the world. Yeah.
No, you don't need our presence to hate us, actually. It's astonishing.
Just to take the flip side of this, how do you explain Jewish prominence in either high status cultural contexts or powerful positions in governments? I mean, you know, obviously the point you just made still stands, that, you know, even if we're overrepresented in really any of these contexts, we're still never the majority in those contexts, right? Because you're talking in America, if 2% of the population, if we're 20% in any field, well, then that's a tenfold, quote, overrepresentation. But, you know, we're still not the majority of anybody, you know, doing the work anywhere outside of a synagogue, I would imagine.
Yeah. Let me tell you a funny story about that that will actually illustrate, I think, both how we got there and what's happening to that. So I got COVID a couple of years ago, maybe a little bit less, and I was supposed to do a doctor's daughter's wedding. And I called him and I said, listen, I just want you to know, this is in Los Angeles. I have COVID. He said, I'm getting you to Cedars tomorrow morning and you're going to get monoclonal antibodies. So next morning I'm at Cedars because he wanted me to do his kid's wedding, which I did in the end. And the nurse is giving me monoclonal antibodies. She goes, how did you get here so quickly? Usually it takes a couple of days. And I said, well, honestly, if you're gonna get monoclonal antibodies, it is good to be clergy to the Jews. And she said, that's true, but in a decade, you're gonna wanna be clergy to the Indians. And I thought, that's part of the point is, yes, this is a certain moment in history where the skills that Jews have happen to be very suited to the kind of skills that are needed to succeed in the modern world. But there are a lot of other groups that haven't actually had the opportunity, that now have the opportunity, that are going to, you know, flood the market essentially. And that's going to change. But the reason, my explanation at least for why Jews have been so successful, is their culture trained them to it. It was a portable culture. It was a literate culture. It was a culture where scholarship had greater status than anything else. And then you come into economies where numeracy and literacy and brain work matter much more than physical labor. And it's almost as if we were primed by our tradition to do well.
Mm. Okay, so back to the right and the alt-right and the far right. I mean, one thing that's so confusing about our current information landscape, and you just look at what's happening in the media and on social media, you have various characters seeming to play well with each other. I mean, they signal boost each other. They are clearly on friendly terms. I mean, I'm thinking of people like Elon Musk and Tucker Carlson and Vivek Ramaswamy and Jared Kushner. And I mean, these are all people who are either in Trumpistan or Trumpistan adjacent. They're, I think, united in their hatred of so-called elites, all the while being among the elites. These are people that are standing outside our various institutions and condemning them as irretrievably corrupt. And, you know, everyone I just mentioned, with the exception of Jared Kushner, I would be reasonably sure, is someone who has either said great replacement theory is absolutely real and is just, you overlook it at your peril, or there's been some flirtation with it. Again, none of this is the far right, you know, white nationalist, quasi-neo-Nazi fringe, but it's also not hostile to that either, right? So like, right. All of these people focus, you know, 100% of their energy in decrying what we're about to decry, the moral confusion of the far left, and they spend exactly none of it worrying about the various monsters at their backs on the right. My view is that we can keep both of these problems in view at the same time. What's your sense of the right-of-center problem in American political life? And, I mean, you take it at any strata of society you want, but I mean, there seems to be a populist moment on the right that is heavily infected by, if not frank anti-Semitism, a disinclination to see the anti-Semitism further to the right.
I think that it's even more, I mean, you're being careful in the way you frame it. It's a sort of delight with flirting with that anti-Semitism without pronouncing it yourself, giving openings to it and seeing it sort of rise up, which is kind of amusing and fun. And it's not only in America, of course. You know, I was recently in Hungary. The same game is going on there as here and in other countries as well, where the populace and the energy of populism, and let us be honest, the votes of populism and the engine of fundraising and other things and all of that is in some ways intersecting with anti-Semitism, and public figures understand that they don't have to be anti-Semites to get frank anti-Semites, open anti-Semites, to get the boost from the populist approval, because a wink and a nod is sufficient. You only have to say, you know, look, I really think that, you know, I'm not, that intellectual sophisticates are betraying us. And people know that you're saying Jews. People know that cosmopolitans means Jews, or that the intellectual elite means Jews. And so you can get tremendous support and encouragement from this. There's a nice Hebrew word, chizuk, which means kind of strengthening from it, without needing to say anything explicitly anti-Semitic. So I think Elon Musk has done this numerous times, and I don't believe for a moment that he doesn't know what he's doing when he says things that encourage anti-Semites to say, go Elon. And he's not alone. So Even something as contentious and contended as there are fine people on both sides, well, if you're marching with Nazis, you're probably not a fine person. But if you say that, then you say, but I'm condemning Nazis, you have played that double game of encouraging people that want to understand you're on their side without saying explicitly, I'm on your side. And this game has been played on the right to the Jews' detriment now a lot. And it's, as you said, it's being done by people who have tremendous cultural influence and sway.
Let me bend over backwards to defend two people who I'm really not in the habit of defending now. So with Trump, I mean, the fine people on both sides moment, there's no question that there was a clip from a press conference there that was edited to make it seem like he was just, without caveat, endorsing the white supremacists as fine people.
Which he wasn't. I totally agree with you. Right. He was not doing that.
So there's that, but I take your point that he's sloppy enough that you think that there, in the end, there must be some method to his madness where he's unwilling to, in a very straightforward way, disavow people who support him, who really any decent person would just at every opportunity disavow. I mean, whether it's anti-Semites or it's David Duke or it's white nationalists or it's the Proud Boys or it's QAnon. I mean, whenever he's posed an ultimatum, like tell us exactly what you think about X, he will say something mealy-mouthed of the sort that is invariably, a testament to his own narcissism. I mean, the formulation is usually something like, well, they really seem to like me, so they can't be all bad. Or I mean, it's like he just turns it back to himself.
Right. If you say to me, is Trump an anti-Semite? I think, no. I don't actually think that that's what's going on. And I can't look into people's hearts. I don't know what he thinks or what Elon Musk thinks in their heart. But I don't see them as being explicitly haters. That's not the issue. The issue is exactly what you said, which is if I can just wink and get people to buoy me up, then,
I just don't see, perhaps I'm naive, but I just can't imagine. I mean, in Trump's case, I really don't have a theory of mind. It all just breaks down. It's like, you're getting sucked into a black hole and the normal physics changes. But with Elon, it just seems to me that there's no possible advantage for him to be confusing his fans about what he thinks with respect to Jew hatred. I don't know if you've seen him going after George Soros. I don't know enough about George Soros to know exactly what he's focused on there, but I'm imagining that, George Soros funds lots of left-wing groups and causes, and for that reason, many people right of center view him as fairly culpable for having delivered us the monstrosity of diversity, equity, and inclusion such as it now exists, and we'll be talking about that. So insofar as that's true, if he is a major funder of district attorneys who won't jail anyone, even if they're, ransacking a CVS near you, provided the color of their skin is the appropriate shade, well, then it's easy for people to just say, okay, this is an awful degradation of our society being funded by this billionaire. Let's criticize him for that. And it's perhaps unfair to say that is, given that he's this guy is famously maligned by real anti-Semites, that now you're party to the anti-Semitism casting a shadow over the whole thing.
I agree with you. I mean, he's retweeted one or two things and said one or two things that have been more explicit, but I think the same, it's actually not so much a point about Donald Trump or Elon Musk. It is a point about the fact that the anti-Semitism on the right looks for any opening that suggests that there is encouragement of the ideology, and it finds it in, I think, lots of places, even if the putative encourager is not themselves, anti-Semitic or trying to goose anti-Semitism, but you can call the rhetoric sloppy, you can call it, conscious winking, I don't know. But it's clearly there, and you see it in the responses that people get on social media, and I see it in my own feed, where people will write, as Elon Musk said about you people,
whereas Donald right. Trump said about yeah. you people. I try very hard to stay apolitical. I am not telling people they should vote for this person or that person. I obviously have my preferences, as I know you certainly have yours. But I try to be like consistently vigilant against anti-Semitic provocations. And they clearly exist among the characters we've mentioned, whether by design or inadvertence.
Yeah, well, it's often in what isn't said, right? I mean, so it's the fact that, you know, in Trump's case, when asked about the Proud Boys, all he can say is, you know, stand back and stand by, right? Like, which is just it's not what you would say if you recognize the problem of right-wing militia lunatics in our society, you know, agitating for their own power, right? I mean, you would
right.
completely disavow them, and you would leave nothing left to the imagination. And so it is with Elon.
One of the things, though, that I have actually seen is that people on the right people who are clearly not anti-Semites on the right don't take anti-Semitism on the right that seriously. And people on the left who are not anti-Semites by and large mm-hmm. have not, maybe now is changing, taken anti-Semitism on the left that seriously.
Mm, right, right. Yeah, it's the single focus to the other side of the aisle, which I think is so corrupting of one's ethical compass. Yeah. Okay, well, let's go leftward.
Right.
And get a picture of what's happening there. I mean, this is, you know, the difference for me has always been, you know, if you go far enough right, you meet just frank Nazis, right?
You literally meet
people with swastikas on their foreheads. If you go far enough left, you have met, you know, up until the recent weeks, you have met people who were not at all violently disposed toward Jews. They're just confused people whose social justice hysteria has caused them to view everything in terms of, you know, a very American
mm-hmm.
framework of, you know, oppressor and oppressed dynamics that just really break down along the lines of the African-American experience. Like, everything gets mapped to that. It's what people like Ibram X. Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates have done to our civil rights thinking, where, you know, you can't just not be racist, you have to be anti-racist. And, you know, white guilt is a kind of original sin which can never be expiated. And everything, you know, including, you know, objective standards in education, is a matter of power and oppression and privilege. And you force everything through that filter. And what falls out at the other end, if you're a Jew, is, again, the view that you're not only not among the oppressed, you're among the most privileged. And you're worse still, you're this model minority against whom African Americans and other minorities are always subject to invidious comparisons based on the success, you know, the success of the Jews in all walks of life. And so it's just, there's this animus toward Jews, but it never seemed to be the kind of thing that would give us our next Kristallnacht until October 8th, right? Where we feel, okay, now this is now supercharged in its alliance with people who are actually explicitly celebrating the murder of Jews.
Right. Exactly. So I used to say, and not me alone, this it's hardly original with me, that the anti-Semitism of the right tended to be more violent and the anti-Semitism of the left more ideological and more pervasive. Because the anti-Semitism of the right, you have to go pretty far right to find overt anti-Semites. And they, obviously, even the people we were talking about who are all the people who you listed, none of them are overt anti-Semites the way the far
right
is. But on the far left, it's an ideological movement that actually has real sway in politics and culture in America, but did not seem to be predisposed to violence the same way. And then October 7th hits, and you have people celebrating brutal murder, rape, torture, unable to condemn it. So it was a real, it wasn't exactly a wake-up call to
oh, the left can be violent. It was the degree to which the Jew has been entirely categorized as a person incapable of being a victim, and whoever does something bad to them, incapable of actually doing something that is morally bad. Because the oppressed-oppressor dynamic is the oppressed cannot be bad, the oppressor cannot be good. And that was exactly why you had smart, able, thoughtful, otherwise decent students on campus October 7th on that day, before Israel had done anything in response, celebrating what Hamas had done, which was unthinkable to someone who sees all human beings as moral agents, no matter where they stand on the political spectrum. But that's not part of the ideology, and therefore it doesn't map. And as you said, you know, the oppressed oppressor thing stumbles on the Jews because the Jews have been as persecuted as any people in history, and yet they're doing well. So what do you do with that? And the decision is, I mean, not as though there was a cabal, but the implicit decision is they must therefore be oppressors, and anything they do is bad.
Yeah, and to bring this back to Harvard, you had within hours of the attacks on October 7th, I mean, literally this was October 7th still, it was not October 8th, you had 33 student groups sign this fairly literate open letter. I mean, among the offenses of the letter was that it was so poorly written, in my view, but it was the worst aspect of it was that they claimed to believe that Israel was entirely responsible for the violence of October 7th.
Right.
And this is before Israel had done anything in reprisal. You know, I'm tempted to be as forgiving and patient as is as sane to be in circumstances like this. So you can only imagine that there are many students who didn't know the details. They certainly, you know, if you're in a massive crowd chanting from the river to the sea, we know that many of them don't know which river and don't know which sea. And they even if they do, they don't know the genocidal implications of that chant. But there are many, many people who know exactly what they were endorsing and to this day endorse. And you know, many of these people are in the Muslim community, and and you know, they're explicitly supportive of Hamas or jihadism in general, or, you know, to a more relaxed standard, Islamism. And it's I mean, there's just this this alliance has been visible for many, many years. I mean, this was visible when we had a women's march, you know, some years ago, and one of the organizers was a hijabi who was a fairly explicitly Islamist in her political orientation, and yet, you know, there the veil was being celebrated by women all over this country as a sign of female empowerment.
Yes.
It was fairly deranged even then. Give me, I know that your deliberations on the anti-Semitism panel at Harvard are confidential, and you want to honor that, but you did resign from it. And I'm just wondering what you can say about it, and let's now talk about what can be done on university campuses to correct course.
So the right in the wake of the attack, I had a conversation with the president, and she was clearly shaken by what happened and by the response to her initial response, which has a curious parallel, which actually just occurred to me. I didn't think about it before. Her first response felt as lawyered as the presidential answering on the commission did. It was very tepid, and the campus continued to explode. And so she was clearly shaken. And we had a conversation, and she asked me to be, if I would, in this conversation or the following one, would I be on this group? And I said, sure. And it was composed of people who were really serious about this issue. And the essence of it was an advisory panel. So as you said, it had to be confidential. But what was clear at a certain point was not that Harvard didn't have any intention of doing anything ever. There were stuff that was going to happen, but that this was something that required real, urgent, serious, immediate action, and that this university, for whatever reason, and we can all speculate about the reasons,
was prepared gradually to do something that would sort of, in an indirect way, help perhaps to a little bit alleviate. I don't even know how I would need a thesaurus for all the synonyms that I'm searching for. In other words, it wasn't going to happen. And I was already feeling that, and especially because I was the one person on the panel who had, I had never attended Harvard. I went to Penn, which had its own problems, and I was new. I covered both. Hilarious. Right, exactly. I covered all of them. And
if anyone's worse than Harvard, it's Penn. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And I was maybe it's me. I was new to the institution. And I was clearly a representative of the Jewish community, not of Harvard. And the Jewish community kept saying to me, how are you giving cover for this? How can nothing is happening? It's getting worse and worse. We're hearing more reports and more reports and more reports. And how can you stay on this panel? And I thought, no, I'm gonna do this. I'm going to work it. We're going to make a change. And then we had the hearings. And I watched
Before Congress.
Before Congress,
the three presidents before Congress.
So, yes. Thank you for elaborating. You know, when you live something, you assume the whole world has lived it. Everyone knows the hearings, but that's obviously not the case. The three presidents of MIT and Penn and Harvard all went before this congressional committee. And while certain answers, one answer in particular, got lots of play, for me, that wasn't the issue. The issue was, all 5 hours that I watched, I kept waiting for someone to like pound their fist on the table and say, I'm disgusted at what's going on at my own university, and I'm not going to allow this to happen, and this is not okay, and I'm indignant, and I'm angry, and to offer some vision of what might happen. But instead, you got the same kind of, We at the university do things with slowly and with process, and we're careful. And in the meantime, I know kids who are afraid to go to class at the best universities in the world. They're afraid to go to class. And I'm thinking, I can't be a party to this. So I informed everyone that I was going to leave, and then I left, and I posted something. And by the response, I saw the pent-up frustration and fury that was felt by so many, and not only in the Jewish community, but obviously in the Jewish community, at these institutions, and people just tearing their hair out, like, how can this be the best that America has to offer?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, as many people have pointed out, it was really the double standard and the hypocrisy that were on display there in their testimony that got under everyone's skin. And it's because everyone knew that had there been mobs of students calling for the eradication of black people or the eradication of trans people, the institutions would have acted immediately, right? They would have immediately recognized that this is just so toxic as to be unacceptable. And also, just they would have been scandalized by it in a way that they weren't scandalized by frank confessions of anti-Semitism. And they wouldn't want to be associated with it. I mean, they would expel students without apology, saying, you don't represent our institution. We don't belong on your CV if you think black people everywhere should be killed.
Right.
I mean, that's so far beyond the pale.
Right.
You know, get out of my office. I don't have to finish this sentence. Right. You're gone. That would have been the attitude of the institution. And yet they showed an endless tolerance and, you know, lawyerly nicety for the freedom to call for genocide against Jews. And that was the thing that just went off like a nuclear bomb for everybody.
So Danielle Allen, who is a professor, I believe she's a professor of government at Harvard. I'm very, very well-regarded, liberal, African-American, brilliant and impressive woman, wrote an editorial in the Washington Post where she talked about the fact that free speech is not the same as creating a culture of intimidation. And she said, if students were yelling white power, I wouldn't send my kid to that university. And I thought that is an almost perfect, because white power is not a call for genocide.
Right.
But it's sort of implied in a certain way that it's very close, if not exactly a call. And yet, who would send their kid to a university where that was the chant that students day after day after day would chant in Harvard Yard? And so I think everybody knew. That's why it was almost to me inexplicable how unable to read the room
those presidents who obviously have political and other skills, or they wouldn't have reached the pinnacle of their career. President of MIT, president of Harvard, president of Penn. I mean, you don't get there unless you have some skills. And from the first 5 minutes, I already thought, no, this is not going well. And I wanted it to go. I mean, I was rooting for it to go well. I really wanted it to. And it was not good. What can I tell you? It was not good.
Mm. Well, I have a sense that what these institutions think they need to do is the opposite of what I think they should do. I mean, I think, and this may be some place where you and I have different intuitions. I mean, you know, perhaps not, but we'll find out. My sense is that they will view their response to this eruption of anti-Semitism as having been inadequate, but inadequate in the direction of, okay, now we need further policies, right, more explicit policies, more bureaucrats to administer those policies so as to shore up our institutions against yet another form of bigotry,
right,
now of the anti-Semitic flavor. We've done such good work to protect Black people and trans people and every other sort of beleaguered minority. And it just broke down with the Jews, and now we've got to protect the Jews. Whereas I view their failure really in the opposite terms, which is they were incapable of seeing what was wrong with the protests on their campuses because they're so morally blinkered by their diversity, equity, and inclusion ideology that they just, what they need is a full software update of their brains, right? And they need, like, they need to gut the DEI apparatus everywhere. All these DEI bureaucrats should be fired, and these schools should get out of the business of issuing proclamations on everything that hits the top of the fold on the front page of the New York Times. They should just say, listen, if there are innocent people being killed anywhere, you can rest assured that we object to that. And our job is to educate people. We're not, and you should be able to talk about anything you want to talk about in our seminar rooms, however extreme these ideas. But these campuses have to be places where people are free to go to class, events start on time, no one gets deplatformed by howling mobs. And so your rights to protest are significantly abridged here. You know, if you're pounding on people's doors and making them feel unsafe, we're going to expel you, right? Like, you can talk about anything in a civil way. This is a culture of civil conversation, and you can play devil's advocate on any point, however obscene that may seem in a seminar room, but this is not a place where you get the heckler's veto and you get to shout people into silence and you get to mob them in hallways and prevent their movements, et cetera, et cetera. And if you do any of those things, we're just going to kick you out without apology.
So,
do you think that's the wrong intuition?
We can't even argue about this because I essentially agree with you. Mm. I would put a slightly different spin. Part of the problem is they can't do that now because no one will believe them. If they say, okay, we got the memo, no more political pronouncements, everybody in the world is going to think, yeah, until there's another George Floyd incident, and then there will be a political pronouncement. You'll all of a sudden rediscover that, in fact, the university stands against that. So in theory, I agree with you, but in practice, I think to do that right now would almost be an act of bad faith, even though I think that's the right thing to do. Also,
I had thought that the University of Chicago was taking
I think
that
they
path.
Did. I think they did, but they have a history. That's the thing, is if you did it on October 6th, it would be okay. But if you do it now, everybody's going to think you're doing it just so you can avoid this particular controversy. But that's a tactical issue. That's not a, you know, we agree on the strategy. We agree on the larger issue. And they also need, but there are two things that I would add. One is implicit in what you said, but one is different. The implicit one is I really think that campuses have to have mandatory training in civil discourse. That should just be part of the orientation or part of your first year, something that you have to learn how to disagree about things that you feel deeply about in a way that is productive. And I've said to many students, I said, look, Palestinian students, Islamist students, progressive students, people who radically disagree with me about Israel, come to my office, talk to me, yell at me. I mean, I'm an old rabbi. I've been yelled at before, and I can sit there quietly until you finish, and then we can talk. Because you have to learn those skills, and I'm willing to listen, and they have to be able to listen to each other. So that's one thing. The other is, I really do believe that, especially on these campuses, there has to be an education about anti-Semitism and also about Jewish history, because actually Jews stand at the fountainhead of Western civilization, and you need to know something about that, because you're about to get all these students who say, you know, Jews have no connection to the land of Israel. In 2 weeks, they're all going to be singing Christmas carols to Jesus born in Bethlehem. And I want to say to them, like, don't you understand a certain disconnect here? Are you aware of what Jesus's religious affiliations were, who was born in Bethlehem in a land that you say Jews have no connection to? So because it stands at the root of Christianity and because it's so central to Islam, I think that people need to understand something, just as you study the Greeks, and you should study the Greeks if you want to know the fountainheads of Western civilization. You also need to study something about Judaism and anti-Semitism, especially now when it is rife on campus. And remember, the campus is always a reflection of the culture. It's not just campus. It's also in the culture.
Hmm. One thing that I have not paid really any attention to over these recent decades that it's been brewing, but no doubt you have noticed it and know much more about it than I do. And it's a precursor to much of what we have seen of late, which is the BDS movement on campuses. That I don't know when that started, but what has been your perception of that all these years? Is it synonymous with, I mean, this is the larger question of whether anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism or to what degree those concepts can be demarcated. What is BDS and what are its what has it been its effects, and where do you come down on the anti-Jewish versus anti-Zionist distinction?
So BDS means boycott, divestment, and sanctions. It's taking the same approach to Israel that people took to South Africa by trying to cripple its economy by not buying products there. One of the just unfortunate byproducts, as some Palestinians have said, is that, you know, Palestinians, most of them, many of them, I won't say most, but at least many of them, they make their living in Israel by making products in Israel. And if those factories go out of business, then Palestinians don't, because unfortunately, despite the fact that it's important to note, more than 6 times per capita what America and the Marshall Plan gave to Europe has been given to every inhabitant in Gaza, it ends up in rockets and tunnels and doesn't end up in businesses and supermarkets. So they go to Israel to do, and many of the people who were killed in the kibbutz were actually people who would take people from Gaza back and forth from Israel to Gaza, but that's another tragic story. But BDS is, I think the same about BDS that I do about the anti-Zionism, anti-Israel thing, which is, there are some people, I mean, anti-Semitism thing. There are some people who probably believe that Zionism is inherently illegitimate who are not anti-Semitic. But the overlap is so tremendous that it's almost able to be synonymous in the sense that, and I'll tell you why I say that. First of all, there are 50 Muslim states in the world. I have never heard anyone say one of them should be eliminated for any behavior. Germany, after World War II, behaved worse than any state in the history of the world. Nobody said there should be no more Germany. That's it. We're done with Germany. I mean, the only state I have ever heard, ever, people say there should be no more of this state is the only Jewish state that ever existed. And that's a very peculiar overlap that I think people should think about pretty carefully. And then the idea that it's colonialist, I mean, a colonialist is somebody who comes from somewhere and takes your land. The Jews came from there. That's where they came from. Many came back there, but we're talking about there were 500,000 Palestinians in 1948, and now there are many, many, many millions, which, by the way, puts the lie to the idea of genocide. But it was a land in which
has a long and complicated history, was never a separate individual state other than Israel. It was a succession of empires. So to say that I think that Israel shouldn't exist, but I have love for the Jewish people, is not exactly oxymoronic, but it's close enough to be moronic.
Yeah. Well, as someone who almost said one of these moronic things in the past, my sense was that, you know, my atheist bona fides,
mm-hmm.
my sense was that having any state organized around a religion was intrinsically divisive and retrograde and ultimately not, ideal. And this obviously extends to any Christian state or any Muslim state.
Right.
And so I would extend that to Israel as well. And so there's a distinction between a Jewish state and a state for Jews being...
Right.
Having a safe place for Jews is obviously something one wants and needs no defense given the history of genocidal anti-Semitism. But whether it's a religiously conceived state, I mean, the only thing that puts pressure on this notion, from my point of view, is the currently effective genocidal aspirations of their Muslim neighbors, right? Like that.
Right.
Like if they were not surrounded by people who wanted to kill them for religious reasons, well, then yes, then it would be indecent to have a religiously defined state, from my point of view. But given the nature of the anti-Semitism, well, you know, you just kind of come slamming down Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and you know, I simply don't care at that point.
So I want to make two points for your listeners who may not have thought of this. And also, I, by the way, agree with, and I'll agree with you in part two in a perhaps surprising way. But number one is, when you said surrounded by, you know, homicidal neighbors, I mean, America is uniquely blessed. Like, the greatest blessing of America is Canada, Mexico, ocean. We have a geographical buffer that is unique in the world, and Americans find it very hard to understand that people who want to wipe you out live literally next door. I mean, you can see them, you can see their houses, they're right there. So we're not talking about far away. We're not talking about the distances of America. We're talking about a state that's smaller than New Jersey, and the people there are literally right there, and Israel is surrounded by nations that are either mildly hostile or homicidally, you know, motivated. The second point is, look, I wish, probably along with you, that actually there was more separation of synagogue and state in Israel for lots of reasons that we don't need to get into now. I think that it's not good for the state, and frankly, I think it's not good for Judaism either.
Mm.
But also, Judaism is a category that is different because we try to put it into Western boxes. Is it a religion? Is it a nationality? Is it an ethnicity? Is it a tribe? Is it a family? And the reason none of those exactly fit is that Judaism is pre-Western. It wasn't actually conceived in the Western world. It comes from the ancient Near East. And so it's sort of a religious family, in the sense that you're born into it, like you're born into a family, but you can also join it, like you can join a family. And the only way to really leave it is to choose another family. And that's traditionally been true in Judaism. So to call it a Jewish state doesn't necessarily mean it's a religious state the way a Christian state would be a mm-hmm. religious state. It is an ethnic state, a national state, a religious state. It's some unique combination of those things.
Yeah. And to some degree, it's been defined by the history of anti-Semitism. I mean, I know Zionism obviously predates the Holocaust, but in terms of the justification for Israel, it's easy to draw a lot of moral energy from the genocide of that was the Holocaust, and you know, and just this history of, you know, pogrom and persecution. I mean, this is, you know, when you were talking about the Jews being indigenous to the region, you know, they were, you know, we didn't spell this out, but they were indigenous to all of these other Middle Eastern countries too,
right?
Like Iraq and Syria and Yemen and Egypt, and they were run out of those countries in punishment for the founding of Israel in 1948. And no one, strangely, no one is worrying about their right of return
no.
to their homes in Baghdad.
There were 750,000 Jews that left the Arab Middle East. And by the way, the Jews who came to my synagogue, the Jews of Iran, they go back to like 400-500 BCE. I mean, they're not Sephardic Jews because they didn't come from Spain. They came from Persia. They were like exiled from Israel to Babylon, which became Persia, and have stayed there for 2,500 years until they were kicked out.
That had to have given you a unique political vantage point in America because it has to be a disproportionately conservative congregation.
Let's go back for 1 second to a subject that I said I don't talk about politics, but many of in the Persian community were supporters of Trump, and they would sometimes say to me, you know, Rabbi, you're a very nice man, but you grew up in Philadelphia. You don't know what it's like to grow up in Tehran, and we just see the world from a different vantage point because we've had experiences you haven't had. And, you know, and they were right. I grew up in Philadelphia. I didn't grow up in Tehran. And so I always like had a certain, I tried to have a certain humility about what my political convictions were because I knew, even though I have my own strong political convictions, but I also knew that like, as a rabbi, it was my job to represent the Jewish experience, not my Philadelphia Ashkenazi American Jewish experience. And I learned a lot from seeing a very different vantage point.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what do you make of the double standards at the UN, which are now so well attested to at this point as to be simply not debatable? To say that Israel is treated as a Jew among nations is just a statement of objective fact at this point. How do you explain that to yourself, and what, if anything, can be done about it?
I used to have the statistics at my fingertips. I've forgotten now, but it's roughly like, let's say there are 800 resolutions to condemn bad behavior in the world. You know, 760 of them are anti-Israel. And like somebody noticed that something bad was happening in Tibet. It's clear to me that it is motivated both by anti-Semitism and also by the counting on anti-Semitism, by which I mean I might not be anti-Semitic, but I know if I attack Israel, all the anti-Semites are going to like me. It's kind of the same virtue signaling. What is the opposite of virtue signaling? Sin signaling that I was talking about to the right, which is the population of the world has decided here is an easy target for all of us because nobody is going to defend them. So let's just condemn every time. And for those who don't know, it took 2 months for the UN Conference on Women to say explicitly that the rape, butchery, mutilation, sexual violation of women in Israel was wrong, and to name actually the women of Israel as opposed to saying all sexual violence is wrong. And no other country in the world, not one of all the hundreds of countries in the world, would it have taken more than a day. So this makes my blood boil. I think the United Nations is a corrupt, it's just an institution that represents anti-Semitism, even if many of its members obviously themselves are not anti-Semitic, but they are collaborators and colluding in it. And what can be done to repair it? I'll quote your earlier comment on the colleges. You need to reboot the software. I'm not sure that's possible, but that's what you need.
So what are you doing next? What are your, you're still at Harvard, right?
I'm teaching a class called Sources of Jewish Spirituality in the spring, which is not going to be politically motivated. I'm still consulting with people. I'm the inaugural rabbinic fellow at the ADL, so I'll be working on anti-Semitism through that venue as well. And I work with something called the Maimonides Fund, which is a wonderful organization in New York. So I'm doing a bunch of different things, but it has become clear to me that this will occupy the year that I'm there, because now I have had so many different contacts and discussions. And I really believe that as long as I'm there, I can't turn a blind eye to it, especially to the students who've reached out to me. And I did not know, I mean, I was already in contact with many of them. I had no idea that resigning from the committee was going to makes so many of them turn to me as somebody that they thought represented their interests because they feel abandoned.
I've heard rumors that Jewish attendance at Ivy League universities is way down, or maybe it's Jewish acceptance at Ivy League universities. At one point, there was something like 25% of the student body was Jewish, and now it's like 4%. Do you know anything about this?
Right. So this is a contentious issue, depending on who you ask. I mean, a lot of people think it's reflective of, again, a bias against Jews at these universities because the drop has been precipitous. And it is something like, you know, goes from a quarter to between 5 and 10%. Some of the factors we can certainly understand. There's greater international acceptances and also the whole DEI machinery and the attempt to get more diverse populations. And Jews are not considered a minority, strangely enough, even though they're infinitely smaller as a minority than the minorities who are considered minorities. Yeah. So all those things have played a role. And part of I confess, like, my disposition is fundamentally optimistic. So I have, just like I usually don't attribute things to malice that could be attributed to ignorance, it's hard for me to attribute things to anti-Semitism that could be explained by all these other factors. But I have to say, the accumulation of evidence that stares me in the face makes it impossible for me to be that naive. And if there isn't anti-Semitism at work, then it's practically inexplicable how great the diminishment of, and they'll say to you, well, we don't really know what someone's ethnicity is, but of course you know from the application, the school.
Unfortunately, the Shapiros didn't get in this year.
Yeah, exactly. Right. The Shapiros who are probably, Albanian peasants. Right. No, but it's clear. And also because you put country of origin and interest and all sorts of things. And so I think it's wonderful that there are international students of many kinds, although we didn't really talk about one influence that I think we should at least mention before we close this subject, which is students from the Middle East grow up in many of the countries of the Middle East, imbibing anti-Semitism with their mother's milk. It's what you said about Ayaan Hirsi Ali in Somalia, for God's sake, which is if you grow up in Yemen or you grow up in Syria, you don't grow up hearing that Jews are nice people like everybody else. You hear the most awful things about them. And then when students from the Middle East come to college, this is obviously not true of all of them, but it's true of a considerable number. There is a great unlearning that needs to take place. And that's not always easy to do.
Yeah, I mean, this is taboo, certainly on the left, to acknowledge, but the level of bigotry and moral confusion endemic to Muslim societies everywhere is, if you actually were going to try to line it up with the analogous derangement in American society, you'd have to push extraordinarily far right into white supremacist, neo-Nazi crazy town.
Right.
Right. I mean, when you're just talking about the level of just kind of default hatred against, of people and, conspiratorial thinking. Yep. And it's just, there's a lot to deprogram. And so, and also this is another piece that's a different side of the machine, but it's quite related. I mean, there's all this funding, this Middle Eastern funding of our academic institutions, which has been fairly insidious. You have Middle East studies departments funded by, the Gulf states or Saudi Arabia. And this is something that I haven't spent a lot of time here of late, but, whenever I have had to debate people about, jihadism and Islamism and conservative Islam, et cetera, you have these experts and pseudo-experts with their foreign-funded sinecures in places like Georgetown, who just absolutely stonewall you on these issues. I mean, there's no problem with Sharia law. There's no problem with how women are treated under Islam. It's like you're just a bigot if you are worried about any of those things. And needless to say, you're an Islamophobe.
I was going to say, first of all, they should come and speak to my congregants who actually grew up there.
Yeah.
But also,
Yeah.
I know that anecdotes are not data, but this one sort of is paradigmatic to me about this whole question. Years ago, maybe 15 years ago, we had a bunch of international students come to a service at the synagogue, and one of them turned out, they were on some scholarship, I don't remember what it was. One of them was from Pakistan, and afterwards he came up to me and he said, I don't even know what to say. I never thought that Jews were like this, that this isn't at all what I was taught, what I assumed, and so on and so forth. And I said to him, do me a favor. When you go back to Pakistan, just tell people. And he laughed. And he said, no one would ever believe me. And I thought, oi, what do you do? What do you do? How do you trigger the vast unlearning that is required to get people to recognize that Jews are human beings, that they're not international devils that control the world, that they don't have evil conspiracies to crush your life, that they've made outsized contributions to the goodness in medicine, in music, in literature, and so on. And the return that they've gotten for that throughout history has been just abominable and horrific, and that it should stop. And unfortunately, I mean, when you see it at the most sophisticated institutions in the world, which unfortunately we had precedent for because it happened in Germany, which at the time was probably culturally the most advanced country in Europe.
Yeah.
It almost makes you want to throw up your hands in despair, but we're not allowed to despair. You're not allowed to despair because you have to have hope in human beings, and I'm not allowed to despair because I have faith.
Yeah. Well, on that note, let's hope for a saner new year, though we will not get it. 2024, particularly in the United States, is not going to be sane. I think we can say that in advance. Hopefully some clouds will have silver linings.
Yes.
David.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for your time.
Absolutely.
And I wish you the best at Harvard, bastion of tolerance and clear thinking.
Thank you, Sam. I will report. Take care of yourself.